It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Milwaukee County launched a new drug overdose dashboard this week with closer tracking and real-time data. The hope is that this dashboard will be a tool that leads to more effective intervention strategies, ultimately reducing the number of overdose deaths.
At a news conference Tuesday, Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley praised the county's Office of Emergency Management for its collaboration and transparency.
But collecting this information is only one piece of the puzzle. Sharing metrics and analytics is equally crucial. By making the data publicly available, it allows residents of Milwaukee County, public health organizations, researchers, local hospitals, and other community stakeholders to ensure that their programs and services are properly informed, effective, accessible, and equitable.
We have a leader of that office with us now. Dan Pojar is the EMS Division Director for the Milwaukee County Office of Emergency Management. Dan, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. We just heard County Executive David Crowley there emphasizing the impact this dashboard could have on a large swath of the community. What do you see as the potential impact for the presentation of this data?
Yeah, so just much like COVID, we also created a dashboard back then, and it was really, the goal was to inform a broad audience, whether it was the general public, fire and EMS to see where hotspots of activity were occurring, public health. It's meant to be a broad tool that serves multiple purposes. And we also see through the media coverage, something like overdoses are actually happening here. It's reported in the news, but we wanted to provide a little bit more granular detail to our, not only our county, but also our communities, our neighborhoods, to see where and who was being affected.
And the dashboard can tell us many different types of stories through data. You can find out overdose death demographics. You can learn the top five most common drug combinations in overdose patients in Milwaukee versus West Allis. How can information from this dashboard be used to reduce overdoses in Milwaukee County? How do you make that connection?
Yeah, so I think it's a multi-agency effort, whether it's public health, our fire departments that we partner with, Health and Human Services at the county, plus many other resources, even pharmacies that are providing like over-the-counter and naloxone. But it's showing that, fentanyl is our largest culprit in a lot of these overdose fatalities. And we can see that it's mixed with other things, and that's in the data that we receive from the medical examiner's office. So when we're able to display that, it helps communicate that, hey, there's absolutely risk for fentanyl to be mixed in with other things, and that's why we should utilize the tools that we have available to us. So there's multiple harm reduction vending machines placed throughout the county. They have fentanyl testing strips. There's xylazine testing strips, so you're able to test a sample of the drug supply and see if there is fentanyl in there, and then hopefully that creates an awareness of, exercise a little bit more caution with that.
Something that I take away from this dashboard is just how community-driven the response should be to the opioid crisis. Like, you just can't crunch and look into state data and have a blanket approach to this crisis. Are you seeing that tailored approach?
Yeah, we are. We're actually seeing different areas. We do have some geospatial analysis, so that's some mapping products that we're able to put together. We haven't released those just yet. There's a kind of a little bit more scrutiny that we try to apply to those from a patient data protection perspective. But we can see hotspots emerging in certain communities. So once we're able to identify those, we actually have created a model that's called our EVE model. It's evaluating vulnerability and equity. So when we look at overdose rates combined with other factors such as, housing insecurity, transportation access, and social vulnerability, determinants of health, we can prioritize areas to really say, hey, if an agency or location wants to host a vending machine that has these supplies, this would be a great spot for that. And we can help with some of that decision-making process using some of the real-time data. And then we've actually seen some results from that already. So in our EMS system data, we've seen approximately 6% decrease in non-fatal overdoses, but we've seen a 41% decrease in naloxone administered by EMS. And our presumption there is that there's so much naloxone available that's low barrier, easy to access in the community, that patients are getting it sooner when they need it And then not necessarily having to wait for EMS to arrive with it to provide that medication.
Naloxone, the medicine that can rapidly reverse an opioid overdose. Do you think that it's these free distribution points that are then making such an impact?
It's not only just the free distribution points, but we even have teams going out from our Health and Human Services Department. And once we identify at times, you know, a high risk or a high activity area, they're actually going door to door, talking with folks, offering what we call a harm reduction or a hope kit. Same thing with our fire departments. If they respond to a scene and say someone's having chest pain, a completely unrelated event, or if they do go for an overdose, we make these kits available to anyone. No questions asked. If they ask for it and it's available, we'll give it to them.
Dan, why are overdoses difficult to track? Why are they complicated?
Some of the data quality issues when it comes to overdoses, you know, there's a variety of presentations that a patient may have. So if someone sees someone, they may appear unconscious. They may have difficulty breathing. They may just not be feeling well, like kind of a sick presentation. We have to come up with a lot of different ways to really scrutinize the data to find, you know, where is a patient? Are they getting naloxone before we get there? Did we give it to them? What are some of the outcomes of those patients as well? So it's a big effort, and that's part of what we've invested with some of our opioid settlement funds is adding some data positions to our team so that we can see some extra effort and more concerted focus on our patient care records.
We're talking about a new Milwaukee County drug overdose dashboard with Dan Pojar. He's the EMS Division Director for Milwaukee County Office of Emergency Management. Dan, looking more personally at you, before you came to Milwaukee, you were an EMS responder in Dayton, Ohio, which in 2017, it had one of the highest rates of overdose deaths in the nation. As an EMS responder working in the opioid crisis, what is one of your frustrations or challenges in doing this work?
Well, I don't know. I'd characterize it as a frustration. It's certainly challenging just in the sheer volume of patients that I was seeing, particularly in that area. And as you mentioned, it was one of the highest overdose fatality rates in the country. Just the sheer volume of patients that we were seeing at certain times, especially when we had a bad batch of drug come through the area, it would just ramp up and we'd see, you know, a lot of patients at one time. But also, you know, there's other emergencies going on. We have patients with chest pain and heart attacks that we need to take care of. Same thing with strokes. I was based out of a health system and we had a very busy emergency department. So there was times that when I was not doing, you know, interfacility transports from one hospital to another, I would be going down to the emergency department and helping out, stabilizing overdose victims and also helping with some of the more acute emergencies and trauma.
Wow. Wow. You mentioned cardiac arrest, stroke, and Milwaukee County has other data tracking dashboards in the works. There's a cardiac arrest dashboard and is in the process, I understand, launching one to track strokes. Can you tell us about the integration here with the overdose dashboard?
Yeah, this ties in actually really nicely with the overdose dashboard is our cardiac arrest one. And that one is currently available on our website. And it ties in for a couple of reasons. Is one, if an overdose goes untreated and that someone that needs naloxone, they're not breathing well, that can and will lead to cardiac arrest. So we also wanted the public to understand that there is, you know, an opportunity for what we call bystander intervention or an intervention from a community member. So that's why, you know, the naloxone, that's the nasal spray, is available to the public. That can be an intervention. The same thing also applies with someone who is in cardiac arrest and may need chest compressions. We're pumping on the chest to circulate blood. But overdose and cardiac arrest may present in a similar fashion. Typically, people are unconscious and they're not breathing normally. They may be gasping or snoring. And if you're not a trained medical professional that can assess for a pulse, you know, you may not be able to tell which one's which. So that's why we put both these out really in tandem. And it shows, too, with community bystander intervention, either from naloxone or chest compressions, that does increase survival rates.
We're learning through the dashboard that these opiates are disproportionately killing Black men in Milwaukee County. Why is this so deadly in this segment of the community?
So we've seen an increase in the Black men population, specifically the 50 and older. And this was actually identified through our partnership with a group called ODFAS. It's the Overdose Public Health and Safety Team. The exact reasons, I think, are somewhat difficult to tease out. But this is absolutely a community that's been identified as high opportunity for engagement, additional education, harm reduction, and also supply with more harm reduction resources.
Is there anything that this overdose dashboard cannot do, cannot supply you through data that is either forthcoming or that you would love to integrate?
Yeah, actually, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, a geospatial component. So, you know, visualization on a map tells a real interesting story. And that's kind of the next phase of what we're trying to move into. To understand geospatially where things are happening in the community. And, you know, it's not necessarily one specific area or neighborhood. It's spread throughout there. I mean, this is an indiscriminate issue, not only in Milwaukee County, but really anywhere.
You're also working with local fire departments with their mobile integrated health teams. What effect does that have on this crisis?
Pretty profound. So we started up a program with our mobile integrated health, also known as community paramedics, to provide a buprenorphine administration. So this is a drug that is safe and effective to give to somebody, especially experiencing fairly moderate to severe symptoms of withdrawal. And this can help temporize those withdrawal symptoms and allow a period of time to where we can, you know, start to engage healthcare and see if we can get access to additional follow-up care. So
wraparound services. Yeah. Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Dan Pojar is EMS Division Director for Milwaukee County Office of Emergency Management. Milwaukee County has launched this new drug overdose dashboard this week to help predict future overdoses. To find substance abuse treatment help, go to the number is 1-800-662-HELP.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, changes are coming to college sports and how athletes profit off of their names, images, and likenesses. A Marquette University law professor weighs in on how colleges could share revenues with athletes.
This revenue sharing, this would clearly constitute pay for play to the athletes who receive it.
That conversation coming up on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The owner of Minocqua Brewing Company is facing criminal defamation charges in Oneida County. It's a rarely used statute that some say runs afoul of the First Amendment.
Kirk Bangstad owns the company and its political action committee. He's been a lightning rod for controversy and publicity. Rob Mentzer reports on Bangstad's conflicts and what his super PAC's finances show.
To some Wisconsin liberals, Kirk Bangstad is a minor celebrity. His Minocqua Brewing Company sells irreverent t-shirts and beers themed around Democratic politics. And he's seemingly always in the news. His super PAC puts up billboards and has funded a string of lawsuits meant to change Wisconsin policy.
I feel like I fight for what I think is right, and I feel like I'm a fighter.
But Bangstad is also a magnet for controversy. To his critics, he's an online troll, more focused on publicity stunts than on changing public opinion. Even political allies say he's unnecessarily confrontational. Mary Hayes is a former chair of the Shawamigan Democrats.
His values and his heart are in the right place, but he's his own worst enemy.
Bangstad has feuded with Northwoods officials since 2020 when he put a large banner on his business supporting Democrat Joe Biden. The town of Minocqua told him to take it down. He refused and appealed to online followers to help him pay the cost of fines and legal fees. Lawsuits and online appeals for money would become a pattern through years of other zoning disputes with the county.
Thank God I have 90,000 Facebook followers and a very large email list that I can ask them to help offset some of my costs from time to time, because I would have gone bankrupt other than that.
Scott Holowinski is chair of the Oneida County Zoning Committee. He categorically denies targeting Bankstad.
Everything is unfair, unfair, and it's all about freedom of speech and his constitutional rights. And basically, he figures if he throws that out there, that exempts him from following any other rules.
In 2023, Bankstad was found liable for defamation in a civil case after falsely claiming the Lakeland Times publisher Greg Walker had left his own brother to die after a hunting accident. Less than a year later, Bankstad posted a doctored photo showing Walker in a sadomasochistic pose. That post is the subject of the criminal defamation charges Bankstad faces now. He maintains that Wisconsin's law is unconstitutional. Walker declined to comment. Days after the arrest, Bankstad wrote that his super PAC had raised more than $20,000 from followers to help cover legal costs. Bankstad's PAC has funded lawsuits in Wisconsin to force masking in schools, end voucher schools, and last year to block Republican Donald Trump from appearing on the ballot. He also sued Oneida County officials. All of the lawsuits made state or national news when he filed them. Three federal lawsuits were dismissed. The Wisconsin Supreme Court declined to hear the voucher schools challenge. Bankstad called these lawsuits the main work of the super PAC.
The four lawsuits are the vast majority of what we spent with the super PAC.
In fact, legal costs accounted for about one-third of the PAC's spending in the last 2 years, according to records Bankstad submitted to the Federal Elections Commission. Of about $1 million in donations, more than $300,000 went to two organizations, Effervescent Blue and NCPS. Neither has a website or a storefront, and they're not registered businesses in Wisconsin. When WPR asked him about these payments, Bankstad ended the interview.
So that question is so out of bounds.
Bankstad says he's been targeted by Republicans, and he accuses WPR of being part of that plot.
The fact that you asked that question suggests that you are part of the Republican Party that's trying to hurt my super PAC and trying to hurt my political activism.
An expert on campaign finance said the payments were unusual, but could be going to people who wanted to mask their involvement with Bankstad. But there aren't many checks on super PAC financing. Experts said donors may stop giving if they think their money is not being spent effectively. Bankstad says he'll keep fighting his legal cases and keep seeking donations. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today.
A Wisconsin Badgers football player left the program this winter to transfer to the University of Miami in a move that set new precedent across college sports.
The Badgers refused to let freshman defensive back Xavier Lucas enter the transfer portal to leave the school after this past season because of an existing revenue-sharing agreement with the player.
Instead, Lucas withdrew from classes at UW-Madison to enroll as a student in Miami with plans to join the football team.
Schools around the country are watching how this all plays out and what it's going to mean for how these revenue-sharing contracts could be enforced.
We check in on the potential impacts for Wisconsin's athletic programs with Matt Mitten, a law professor and executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University Law School. Matt, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Well, my pleasure to join you, Kate.
Lots to break down here. But first, how does the athlete compensation system work now for college players and athletic programs like Wisconsin?
Well, the way that it's supposed to work is all intercollegiate athletes can enter into NIL deals with third parties, including collectives of universities, which typically are alumni, boosters, donors, and they can earn fair market value pay for publicity. It's supposed to be based on the athlete's value to the marketer, advertiser, seller of products or services as, someone who would be advertising, promoting their products. So for example, Michael Jordan, he's made a lot more money from Nike with his name on, shoes and various other products than he did playing basketball for the Chicago Bulls. But what we have in reality is a pay-for-play system where collectives are being used to attract, you know, outstanding players to particular universities based on their athletic ability rather than their fair market value pay for publicity.
So enter Xavier Lucas here. How unique is the case in going around the transfer portal, unenrolling from Wisconsin? What implications could this case have?
Well, really very significant ones. My understanding is he entered into a two-year revenue-sharing deal with the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And for whatever reason, he decided that he wanted to play football at the University of Miami instead. And he's from, you know, South Florida. And his deal is contingent upon the proposed House antitrust litigation settlement. There's going to be a final approval hearing by Judge Wilkin on April 7th, but it's pretty commonplace that universities nationwide are entering into these revenue sharing deals with their athletes in various sports. And, you know, the thought is that the judge will perhaps approve this settlement agreement. Even if they don't, it looks like at least Division I autonomy conference schools are going to go forward with it. And, you know, effective July 1st. So those are contractual agreements. And not only the athlete, but the other universities, you know, have to respect contracts. So here we have a situation where I don't know the facts, but it appears Mr. Lucas may, you know, have violated this revenue sharing agreement with the University of Wisconsin. He's already enrolled at Miami. So, you know, what Mr. Lucas has done raises two issues. Is one, the enforceability of athletes' revenue sharing deals with their respective universities. And two, what's going to be the particular time frame when athletes can say, I'm going to choose to leave my university and go somewhere else?
And you mentioned the House versus NCAA settlement, and which would allow schools to pay college athletes for the first time. And Xavier Lucas's attorney, Darren Heitner, said the revenue sharing agreement he signed with Wisconsin isn't binding because the school can't pay him until this NCAA settles its antitrust suit with the U.S. House of Representatives. And so let's listen here. Here's Heitner explaining his side on ESPN.
The problem for Wisconsin is it hasn't paid him anything. Like, what are they concerned about here? If, in fact, they had paid Xavier Lucas, which they can't do under the current bylaws, that'd be a separate issue.
So if the NCAA finalizes its settlement with the House in April, as you mentioned, does that then make Lucas's Wisconsin contract enforceable?
Well, I think it's likely enforceable now, unless it violates federal antitrust law. It's fairly common for people to enter into contracts that are not going to become effective until a future date. So here, for example, if we assume July 1st, 2025, that's when the contract would become effective, and presumably Mr. Lucas would be entitled to payments from the University of Wisconsin for playing football. So to say now that that is not an enforceable contract because he hasn't been paid now makes absolutely no sense. His contractual right to payment wouldn't begin before July 1st of this year because this contract would not become effective until then.
I want to step back here for a moment. Xavier Lucas appeared in 12 games for the Badgers as a freshman. There is the swirling issues around compensation and revenue sharing. But what about fans here? What will there be any visible ways these changes could affect the fan experience in Wisconsin or Marquette or elsewhere?
Well, definitely. You know, traditionally, college athletes, you know, they can choose, you know, wherever they want to play. And, you know, you get 4 years of eligibility. And, you know, historically, the vast majority of athletes have played at one university. But now we have transfer rules that permit athletes to transfer and potentially play at, use their 4 years of eligibility at four different schools. And, you know, this musical chairs, you know, definitely is going to affect at some point fan interest, because you get used to seeing a promising young player as, let's say, a freshman, look forward to him next year. And it's like, oh, well, no, he's no longer here. He went and signed a deal somewhere else. So one of the purposes of these revenue sharing agreements, and I understand a lot of them are multi-years, it would be designed to keep a player like Xavier Lucas at the University of Wisconsin. And let's keep in mind, it was his choice to sign this agreement. But that's the problem, is there isn't an orderly system, and fans do like some measure of continuity.
We're talking about changes to athlete compensation in college sports, name, image, and likeness deals. We have Marquette sports law professor Matt Mitten with us. Matt, Yahoo Sports is reporting that the NCAA is moving to form this new entity to oversee and enforce athlete compensation rules under the antitrust settlement. How could that change the system for Division I schools in Wisconsin?
Well, it's actually not the NCAA doing this. The NCAA consists of, you know, 1,100 schools and, you know, more than 100 athletic conferences. Mm-hmm. This, what you just described, is what the four autonomy or power conferences are proposing to do. So that would be the member schools of the Big Ten, SEC, ACC, and Big 12. And of course, University of Wisconsin is a member of the Big Ten. Marquette University, for example, is not. All of the members of the autonomy conference schools play football at the Division I FBS level. Marquette, of course, does not have a football team.
Could a body like this intervene in a case like Xavier Lucas?
Well, potentially it would, because as I understand, what is proposed is that at least the members of the four autonomy conferences, and likely Notre Dame, so that would be roughly 70 schools, they would form a separate entity, and they would agree on rules like this, like when are athletes eligible to go into a transfer portal? It might be just one particular time period during the year. And it's also proposed that there would be a mechanism for policing the proposed salary cap. And then the other component of it is athletes would still be free to enter into fair market value NIL rights deals with third parties. Mm. And then there would be a system to resolve disputes. For example, if an athlete said, hey, this deal was invalidated, and I think it really was a fair market value contract based on my publicity value, not my value as a player.
An added layer of complexity here: in recent days, the Education Department rescinding guidance from the Biden administration that name, image, and likeness deals fall under Title IX and require equitable distribution between male and female athletes. How were schools balancing NIL compensation between male and female sports up to this point? Or were they?
Well, that's hard to say, because the House settlement agreement really doesn't establish any parameters or requirements on, you know, schools. One, are free to say, all right, are we willing to, you know, spend up to, you know, $20.5 million of our revenues in revenue sharing with athletes? Mm-hmm. And there's not going to be a lot of schools outside the four autonomy conferences whose athletic departments generate the revenues to do that. That's the first thing. But then those that do decide to do so, there aren't, as I understand it, really much in the way of parameters there, other than don't exceed the salary cap. It'd be up to each school to determine how it's going to distribute that 20.5 million to its intercollegiate athletes. And what Title IX of federal law requires is that universities that and colleges that receive federal funds, if any part of the college or university receives it, all of its operations, including the athletic department, are covered by Title IX. Mm. And as applied to athletics, historically, what that has meant is schools must provide athletic participation opportunities proportionally equal for both male and female athletes, as well as provide equal treatment and benefits. So if you're if a university is providing a disproportionate amount of the, you know, revenue sharing to male athletes in revenue generating sports, that raises some very important Title IX issues. And, you know, the Biden administration's approach was, you know, got to comply with Title IX. There's not a carve out or an exception that you can take out, you know, revenue generating sports like football and mm-hmm. men's basketball. But recently the Trump administration withdrew that and is basically taking the position that, you know, revenue sharing payments would not constitute, you know, financial aid assistance or other benefits where Title IX would require equitable distribution between female and male athletes.
Matt, thank you for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Matt Mitten is a law professor and executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University Law School. He was with us to share how changes to name, image, and likeness compensation will affect Wisconsin college sports.
Still ahead in Wisconsin today, it's American Birkebeiner time in northern Wisconsin for cross-country skiers and spectators.
It's really so fun to see the whole world come together in northern Wisconsin and just soak it all in and see what it's all about.
Hit the Berkey Trail next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The American Birkebeiner is one of the largest cross-country ski races in the world, with thousands of people traveling to Hayward every year to ski the nearly 35-mile course through Wisconsin's North Woods.
The tradition goes back over 50 years, though weather conditions have caused concerns and at least one cancellation. But there's enough snow this year for the series of events from today's youth race and para-Berkeys through the full race over the weekend.
Ben Popp is the executive director of the American Birkebeiner Ski Foundation. I talked to him earlier this week in the run-up to the event. Ben, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a beautiful winter day in northern Wisconsin and ready for some ski racing.
Now, the Berkey, it's such an institution in Wisconsin, over 50 years in the making now. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the race and how it grew to such a big part of the state?
Yeah, no, I think the history is really at the core of why it is so exciting. Tony Wise, native of Hayward, Wisconsin, World War II tank veteran. He was actually stationed in Bavaria during the end of the war and came back. He'd seen skiing when he was there and wanted to bring it back to the place he grew up. And so he bought a small resort, Telmark Resort, just north in Table. And after a few years of operation, decided, hey, I want to start a ski race. And he had some Norwegian roots, and he had heard about this lore of this Norwegian prince being saved back in 1202. And it was went on to be the greatest prince ever of and king of Norway. So he thought he would mimic that and create this 55-kilometer race. And northern Wisconsin. They had a similar one in Norway. And so in 1973, Tony, in his infinite wisdom, decided that he thought it would be great to start a race. And 35 brave souls lined up on the start line in 1973. And it's continued to grow and grow from there, where this week we'll have over 14,000 participants and nearly 25,000 spectators right up here in beautiful northern Wisconsin.
And before we get to the skiing, Ben, can you talk about the impact, the tourism, all those people coming in for the local economy and the community?
Well, that's just it. You know, at northern Wisconsin, our heartbeat is all about outdoor recreation and getting people here and snowmobiling, biking, skiing, you name it. And so when it comes to wintertime, snow is just at the center of what makes our economy hum. And so the Berkey alone brings over $25 million of economic impact by bringing nearly 40,000 people here. So, you know, it's staying in hotels and restaurants and gas and bars, et cetera, you name it. So it's folks are not only here often just for a day, but really a week. They make a whole week vacation of it. So when snow comes and we're able to have this event, it really drives our economy, really regionally for all of northwestern Wisconsin.
Now, a reputation of the Berkeys is, yeah, if you want to go there and you want to compete, great, there's room for that. But it also seems pretty welcoming to recreational skiers. Why is that important to the event?
You know, at the end of the day, that's the beauty of cross-country skiing is you can have somebody very new and beginner all the way to the most elite in the world. Last year, in fact, we had the best woman skier in the world, Jessica Diggins, here racing all the way down to people that call themselves doing the cold turkey Berkey. Literally, it's their first time on skis, and they're going to try and make the 55-kilometer trudge. And so it's really a pretty cool scenario when you can have the absolute best athletes in the world all the way down to beginners, all on the same start line, getting the same sort of support, feeling welcomed. And at the end of the day, that's what makes it feel so encompassing of everyone and why we really think it's important to spend as much time on the very beginner skier as it all is to the elite. But you got to come check it out. And once you get Berkey fever, there's no turning back.
Take us on a tour of the scenery that the skiers and the spectators, for that matter, are going to see along the Birkebeiner route.
Well, and the really cool part about the American Birkebeiner route is it starts up in Cable, Wisconsin, and meanders through the rolling hills of northern Wisconsin Heartlands and ends up down in Hayward. And you know, it's county forest, 95% of it. So it's just this beautiful scenery. And as you're rolling through the woods, we have these little aid stations about every 10 kilometers or so that there's got a little warming hut and water. Of course, during the event, there's going to be nearly 100 volunteers at each one of those aid stations, giving them water and bananas and oranges to help keep them moving down the way. There's medical folks along the way, ski patrol, all kinds of media capturing it. And you know, a lot of people that finish the event, again, they're not elite racers. They just like to go out and ski recreationally. They will tell you that it's the most exhilarating feeling going through the woods, stopping away, and then dumping into downtown Hayward, where there's nearly 25,000 people. They say, gosh, it feels like we're in the Olympics. And an interesting anecdote to that was Keegan Randall, one of the most decorated cross-country skiers, Olympians from the U.S., finished in Main Street a couple years ago when she did her first American Birkebeiner and said, she thought it was a more exhilarating finish than the year she did the Olympics and won the gold medal. Wow, that really said a lot.
Now, you mentioned there are different distances of races, and there are also a couple of events to kick off the weekend, the long weekend. The Paraberkey race is one of the first ones. Can you tell us a little bit about that event?
Yeah, you know, when we think about cross-country skiing, we know that there's a little bit of something different for everyone. It's not that everybody has to go out and ski 50-plus kilometers from Cable to Hayward, because that's not what everybody wants to do. But the idea of having a wide variety of activities to create opportunities for everyone. So we start the week off with the Paraberkey, which is everything from blind skiers to people in sit skis. Skiing into downtown Hayward is just exhilarating for them as athletes to get that opportunity. And then it just starts to evolve through a variety of youth events. The Barnaberkey, over 1,000 kids. The Junior Berkey with 400 of those next elite athletes in the making, 13 to 18-year-olds. And it continues. The Barker Berkey is always a fun one when you ski jor, hook up to your favorite canine and go ripping down the ski trail. But the fan favorite, of course, is the Giant Ski. Six people on one pair of skis racing a city block. It's sort of like, you know, potato sack racing meets ice skates. So quite a fan favorite.
Now, do people train for that Giant Ski to coordinate it, or is it like that sack race where it's a special event and you show up and hope for the best?
Well, the funny part, there is been a couple most people just show up. They have a ton of fun, have a couple beers downtown. You know, there's lots of people as the week goes on. It's Thursday night. But there's been a tradition now of two or three teams that actually practice, and it's become quite cutthroat. Is who is going to be the champion of the giant ski. So it's getting to be quite serious.
Off the top of your head, what would be, for the human participants now, not the dogs, the oldest and the youngest that you know of who have participated?
Yeah, so traditionally it's somewhere in the single digits, 3, 4, 5-year-old, all the way up to as old as 90. This year we know that our youngest participant in the Barnaberg is 3 years old, and the oldest we have registered is 86. So you think about that age span. And that's one of the amazing things about cross-country skiing. You can do it your whole life. You don't have to start it when you're young. You can start it at 65 or 75, whenever you want. Or you can start really young and just continue to do it, not only as you grow, but as a family, with friends. It's an amazing sport that I think really embodies being active outdoors and what it's all about living in northern Wisconsin.
Talking to Ben Popp about the American Birkebeiner going on this week through the weekend. Ben, I imagine, you know, we all watch the weather here, right, in Wisconsin. Birkebeiner week, I imagine nobody's watching it more closely than you. What are you seeing in the forecasts for the race this week?
Yeah, I tell you, Mother Nature is something that is really important to us. You know, last year in 2024, no snowflakes in Wisconsin. We ended up having to create a machine-manufactured snow loop of about 11 kilometers. And in all honesty, up until about a week and a half ago, we were in line to do something very similar. It's been, again, quite dry in Wisconsin, as many of you know. And then it turned really cold. So the snows we were getting were just really fluffy and dry and not a lot of body to compact. You know, you think about skiing 14,000 plus skiers down a trail. It has to be really, really hard and durable. And so we were thinking we were going to have to go to this loop course again. But lo and behold, last weekend, the snow dance has worked. It's sort of a mix of chicken dance meets macarena. And it really, we got about 13 inches of snow. And at the end of the day, there's just enough snow to get everybody from Cable to Hayward. And this week, it's been really, really quite cold. You know, upwards of 25 degrees below zero these last couple mornings, which, again, you'd say, well, that's not very good. But actually, it's really helping us firm up this base. Our first event is on Wednesday, and we think the trail's going to end up being really, really good. And so we have to thank Mother Nature for coming through, because it really means so much, not only to the skiers, the volunteers, but just the greater community. So we're very happy with how it's all turning out.
What kind of work is involved in making sure, given whatever snow Mother Nature provides, that it's ready? How much preparation, if any, do you have to do for the trail?
Yeah, it's really, so we end up with about six groomers in their snowcats, the big snowcat grooming machines, that end up going up and down the trail. It takes us about 24 hours to groom the entire trail because it's 40 feet wide. It ends up being about 75 kilometers long because we not only have the Berkey Trail, we have a classic trail alongside it that we get used for the race, some of the youth events. So about 24 hours to get it fully groomed. And we'll end up doing that about five times since this last weekend to get it ready. The more we work it, the more we can compact it and get it hard. Then that only gets you to the edge of Hayward and the end of Lake Hayward, which, by the way, there's plenty of ice this year. We then have to bring in about 125 dump trucks loads of snow to get them from Lake Hayward into downtown. And then we erect the temporary bridge, the International Bridge, which takes folks up and over U.S. Highway 63, which is another 15 or 20 dump truck loads of snow. And so the whole course preparation ends up taking about 10 days. We've been well into it now. As I look out my window, the International Bridge is now standing and has snow on it. And we're just about ready to start putting snow down Main Street. And that means there's no turning back now. It's getting ready to start the American Birkebeiner.
And so where you go to mine the snow elsewhere in the area, or I guess if you don't have snow, like last year, you have to make it for those last spots?
Yeah, you know, it ends up a combination of both. We do make some of the snow that we bring down, as well as farm it off some of the larger parking lots that we use for the event. We just actually, you know, some big fields and the like, we take the snow off of those and then in turn use those, dump truck them into downtown Hayward. And some of the machine-made snow we're using to bolster some of the thinner spots on the southern end. Up in Cable near that north end, it actually catches just enough lake effect snow to make it really quite good as you start to meander south towards Hayward, just a little bit further south. And that's where we end up doing a little bit more work to ensure that whether you're the first skier coming in to win all the prize money or you're the last skier seeking to get the bronze broom, you all have good conditions and have a great time out on the trail.
Now, you mentioned a nail biter with the snow coming in late this year, having to manufacture snow last year. Do you have worries at some points about the future of the race if the snow doesn't cooperate from year to year?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'd be remiss to say that we don't think about climate change and how it affects certainly skiing and snow in northern Wisconsin. Because, again, not only is it a great event, it's just so important to our local economy, whether you're snowmobiling or skiing or ice fishing. And so, you know, we've participated in a lot of panels and looked at what is the climate doing in terms of winter recreation in our region. And ultimately, we ended up having to cancel the race in 2017 because it rained. And so that was when we really flipped a switch and decided we had to start investing, started some capital campaigns and fundraising to invest in snowmaking infrastructure, knowing that if we don't get Mother Nature to dump all the snow we need, we were going to have to start to manufacture it because the event is so important to our regional economy that it was just something that had to go on. So it's certainly something that we look at and take very seriously and know that as we move into the future, certainly the event may change, but at the end of the day, figuring out a way to hold the American Berkebiner will always be important to not only our local community, but certainly our region and the greater globe as part of the World Open.
I got to ask, Ben, obviously you're going to be busy through the whole event. Do you get to do any of the fun stuff? Do you get to go out on skis, giant or otherwise, over the course of the event?
You know, it's funny. I grew up in northern Wisconsin and started skiing the event with my parents when I was quite young. And actually, before I took the job in 2013, had skied 19 Berkebiners and really enjoyed it. I love it. And honestly, since 2013, haven't skied more since then. But, you know, the real enjoyment of standing at the finish line, watching people come in, the enjoyment they've had, all the work the team puts in to help provide those experiences is so rewarding. And I know someday I'll be back out on the snow again, side by side with all the skiers of the Berkebiner. But for now, I'm relegated to the finish line and handing out bananas for those that made the trek.
And apart from those bananas and oranges, are there favorite foods for a post-Berkebiner meal?
Well, of course, in northern Wisconsin, it has to be a good beer and a bratwurst. There's no doubt about it. It's a fan favorite. As you pull into Hayward, you look for the brats and the smoke coming off the grills, find yourself a cold beer or, you know, if it's really cold, maybe a hot chocolate or two. But really, at the end of the day, it's really, really fun to walk down Main Street, nearly 25 or 30,000 people lining it, all kinds of languages being spoken because over 24 countries represented as part of the event. And it's really so fun to see the whole world come together in northern Wisconsin and just soak it all in and see what it's all about.
Well, now I want a brat. Ben, thanks so much for joining us today and have a great event.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. And we look forward to seeing everybody up here in the Northwoods soon.
Ben Popp is the executive director of the American Berkebiner Ski Foundation. Berkey events are running now through the weekend in northern Wisconsin. If you're there or on your way there, send us pictures. We'd love to see them. You can email us, wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Berkey got some good weather news with temps warming up a little after a run of bitterly cold weather around the state.
But the run of cold days had me looking for some indoor activities, and we want to hear about your favorite ways to hunker down when the weather is real cold. Me, the last week included some jigsaw puzzles, soup making, online games with family, a little bit of TV binging. How about you, Kate?
Well, it was some chili making for our crew at dinner, and, you know, I've been more happily shuttling my kids to their swim practices because the pool deck is warm and humid.
Now, how about you? Tell us your favorite indoor activities on a cold winter day, and we could share that in a future show. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. The number's 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.